We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Let me put another log on the fire.
Now, here's a little story I got to tell about...
Tell me a story.
Like my story?
No, not your story. A story.
I have got a story for you.
Back in the old Chicago Stadium, they had these little boxes, and sitting with us was Mike Tyson and Robin Givens.
Hey, I ran into O.J. Simpson the other night. How about that?
Doug jumps up. He runs over there. He gets Bernstein in a chokehold.
I was in Vegas a couple years ago. Hey. Just an honest-to-God true story. Went to Kokomo's, a great little steakhouse.
I had an interesting exchange with him. I've never really reported this.
Yeah, Frank Sinatra was on line three, and baby, he wasn't crooning.
Yao Ming had his number retired that night.
We made the decision to trade Herschel Walker coming back from a jog.
I'm kind of in the shower,
and it was Bo Jackson butt naked, just standing right there.
So I look out the window, and there's Hampton pointing at the door. Excuse me. I said, oh, heck.
I don't think I know any stories.
You don't know any stories?
No.
All right, I'll tell you a story.
I'll tell you a story.
The McNeil and Parkin Show on 670 The Score.
We've absolutely loved the debut of Score Stories. We bring on guests for the sole purpose of putting a smile on your face during these uncertain times and just tell some stories from yesteryear. So it's about time we bring on one of our favorite people on the McNeil and Parkin Show, former Cub, three-time All-Star from MLB Network on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. It's our guy, Dan Plesac. What's up, Dan?
Oh, not too much. I tell you what, I know the world's a crazy world we're living in right now. I live right on the Hudson, guys, and this morning at about 10 a.m., it sounded like the world was ending. I'm literally look out my condo, I'm looking at the Hudson, and the naval ship Comfort was coming in, and I've never seen so many helicopters in my life as this thing pulled up the Hudson River and docked directly across from where I was at. So I knew something big was going on because it was hard to wake me up from a deep sleep.
Yeah, I can imagine right at the epicenter and what we heard late last week from the people in New York who are plugged into the sort of thing that probably, well, now it would be about 18 days away from this when it's expected to reach its peak. So it clearly is a scary time. And I'm sure you've got lots of friends who live and work there, too. You're just right on the edge of it.
Dan, I tell you what, I've been here now for 12 years. I can't believe it's gone that fast. And I literally live an eighth of a mile from the Lincoln Tunnel, and I'm looking right at the Empire State Building, and there is a buzz, there is a traffic, there's an energy of this Northeast that's just here. You love it, you get tired of it, you embrace it. I can't explain it. It's like no place I've ever been, and it has been so eerily quiet for the last week to 10 days, Dan. It is phenomenal. Like, I am right on a busy highway street that is a major throwaway going to the Lincoln Tunnel, and there is not a car to be found. We are on a 10 p.m. curfew at night. If you're out and about, you better have a reason to be out. And you touched on it, Dan. I am right at the epicenter where it all starts. So it's kind of frightening around here. It really is.
How are you holding up?
I'm doing fine. You know what? I'm going a little stir crazy. You know, we met some people at MLB last week. They gave us a computer and a camera and audio equipment, and I'm not a very tech-savvy guy, and they gave us these microphones to use, and we tried today. We did a show that we taped that we're going to air tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern, and MLB Tonight, myself, Harold Reynolds, and Robert Flores. We've got about five or six remote cameras put up. I have one here in my condo, and we're trying to make it a go. I think everybody, we don't know. I think the uncertainty is what is driving everybody nuts. We don't know what, not only baseball and sports, but it's just like nobody knows when this is going to get better. Everybody's kind of wanting that up-to-date information. And the hardest part is just sitting around and waiting, and hopefully at the end of April we'll have hit the apex and it starts to get better. And I guess the part that just drives you nuts is it seemed like a couple of days ago we were kind of braced for, we thought the worst was right around the corner, but from everything that we're hearing, we haven't seen the worst of it yet. That's what's frightening.
Yeah, Dan, I want to ask you, and this is a small thing on the grand scale. It's not important in the big scheme of life, but there was the reality of every team in baseball being assembled in spring training, and with the case of the White Sox, trying to get used to each other, a lot of new faces, a lot of excitement in that clubhouse we experienced in Glendale. These guys really... really seem to have a good vibe going, and I'm a believer in that, and I've expressed a little bit of concern about how you restart the engines on that sort of thing. And again, it's not a big thing. When we look at 2020 years from now, no one's going to remember that, but is that in fact something that is important to a baseball team, building that identity with a lot of new faces in spring training, and how do you recapture it?
Dan, you hit the nail on the head, and I get where you're coming from, and I don't want any listeners. I know, hey, first of all the medical people and the healthcare providers, we get this. We're talking straight sports here, and Dan, it's hard to recreate that again, and this is the dilemma. Players go into the off season, and I'd equate right now, they're in like December, January mode. I talked to my nephew, Zach, who pitches for the Indians. They don't know any more than you, I, or Danny Perkins knows. They have no idea what's in store. They don't know when they meet up. Are they going to meet in one city? Is it going to be Chicago? Are they going to meet back at spring training venue in Arizona? Is it going to be in Florida? None of the teams know whatever area of the country is the safest to work out in. I'm assuming that's what's going to happen. And Dan, I can tell you, I was at camps, and they were just starting to get to that point where the position players were getting bored. They were starting to get tired of it. And you were starting to hear mid-March, like spring training, it's a week to 10 days too long. But for pitchers or guys that had a little bit of a setback, they need that extra time. And now, Dan, guys are like where they're at in December and January. You're throwing, you're staying active, and then you want to try to recreate that all over again. And I think what's going to make this unique, other than any other year in the history of baseball, is everybody's in the same boat, and the concerns, they're not only here, they're worldwide concerns. And I'm not sure how they're going to be able to salvage this season, what the amount of games are going to be. The latest from the Players Association and with the players and management is they're going to try to salvage a season. Now, is that mid-June? Is that mid-July? I've heard that it could go on through the month of October. The World Series will play at a neutral site. But I get what you're saying. You have a young team with some young guys and some new guys that they brought in, particularly the White Sox, bringing a guy like Dallas Keuchel, and the mojo was so good. And now you're going to have to try to recreate that over again. And I think what's really going to be interesting when this does start back up, and hopefully it does, it's going to be a short season. It's going to be a race to see, you know, who's the best team in 100 games or 80 games. It's not going to be that 162. So there isn't going to be a lot of time to get your sea legs underneath you if we start this thing around July.
We're talking to Dan Plesac here, McNeil and Parkins on The Score. You ready for some stories, Sac?
Yes.
All right, so this guy is maybe the biggest like folk hero in terms of stories in all of sports. You guys are rookies the same year in 1986. You're both in the All-Star game in 1989. What Bo Jackson stories can you share?
Hit the home run off of Rick Rushel in the All-Star game. But I'll tell you what. So I can tell you this. 1987, you could have told Bo Jackson what was coming, and he would swing and miss at it three times. I mean, he was a physically imposing. He was like nothing we've ever seen. But it took him a while. But when he did finally figure this out, about mid-1988, all of a sudden when Bo Jackson walked into the batter's box, you were like, oh, my God, like this guy, he's figured it out. And I get brought into a game in Kansas City in 1989 with the man on third in a one-run game to get the last out of the eighth and then to pitch the ninth inning. And Charlie O'Brien was the catcher. And he walks up to me and he says, you know, I get brought into the game. I get handed the ball by Tom Trimblehorn. He leads the mound. You know, Brian's got his mask up on top of his head and all the infielders are standing around. We're going, hey, what sign are we going to use? And I remember Charlie said to me, he started to walk down the mound. Then he turned around and walked back. And he says, hey, make sure if one gets away now that you block home plate. I looked at him and I said, do you see that guy standing at third base? That run's not mine and I'm not letting him run my ass over. That runner, he can score all he wants. I'm not blocking home plate in front of Bo Jackson. He was, I really believe this, if Bo Jackson would have came out and just decided early on in 88 or 89 to just play baseball, I'm telling you without a doubt, I think he would have been a Hall of Fame baseball player. No question in my mind. And that's a big statement. That's how much talent he had.
Who was, in your opinion, if it came down to it, guys you've played with or played against, who would be the guy you most would want next to you in a street fight in the alley?
A guy that you will go, huh? I'm going to tell you, pound for pound, the toughest dude that I played for and a good guy, Pat Hankin won the Cy Young Award, I believe, in 1997 for the Blue Jays. Dan, he was a blue-collar, born, signed out of, went to high school in Detroit, Michigan. He was pound for pound. He was one of those guys, like, when you have your favorite team, and Dan, you guys get a chance to go with the locker rooms, and you get to really find out who the real guys are, like the guys that play hurt, the guys that lay it out there, the guys that, you know, they're not looking to make excuses. Pat Hankin is near the top of my list. That guy, I'm telling you, he pitched with a bad shoulder, a bad elbow. He never complained. He was one of the few guys that when he pitched and you were out there in the bullpen and you were hoping when he came out of the game and you knew when he came out, you wanted at all costs to try to save that game for him because that guy was blood and guts, Dan. I'm telling you, he doesn't get enough credit for how good of a pitcher he was. But Pat Hankin, to me, the toughest dude pound for pound that I played with.
Did you ever, during your playing career, Dan, maybe after a bench-clearing brawl or whatever the case may be, bad umpiring, fans getting unruly, and you're out in the bullpen, did you ever feel at any point unsafe in a ballpark as a major leaguer?
No, I don't think so, Dan. I'll tell you what I'll go back to. The only time that you really started to feel like, man, this is a little crazy. Remember the time the fan ran on the field? I think it was that old Kaminsky and ran on the field and first base coach Tom Gamboa from the Royals, I think. Somebody went on the field and and that was the first time that I remember like, man, this is getting a little out of hand where guys are getting they're half in the bag, they've had too many beverages to drink, and they're hopping the wall and they're running over. And I don't want to get a kick out of it to this day. I love watching those 1970s American League Championship Series, watching Chris Chambliss hit a homer in Yankee Stadium and, like, running through a mob of people to get from second to third at home, forearm shivering guys, knocking guys over. People are trying to grab his hat and his bat and his helmet. And, no, Dan, I never really felt – I mean, there were some ballparks that I pitched in that I would say from a safety standpoint, no, that were intimidating. And old Yankee Stadium, there was no place like that place, Dan. That was the most intimidating baseball venue in the history of this game of baseball, old Yankee Stadium.
Why?
Loud, obnoxious. It's the only place. That day, 1989, and I remember this. The only reason I remember, because after a while, they were having some, when umpires would make bad calls on that day or ball day, they stopped doing that with giving you the giveaway before the game because people were emptying and throwing on the field for a bad call or something went wrong. And I remember in 1989, Dave Winfield wasn't in the lineup that day. And I get through the eighth inning, and I come out to pitch the ninth. I get through the eighth, come out in the ninth. And with two outs, he comes out of the dugout to pinch hit in a one-run game. And I've never – they were beating the bats on the concrete on the seats between them. It's the only time ever in my career that I'm telling you I could feel the mound, like, vibrating and moving. It was the most that place, there was no place like it because when you warmed up in the seventh or eighth inning at a ballpark, at any of the other ballparks, some of them, they're very intimidating. But Yankee Stadium, when you get up and after they play Cotton Eye Joe in the top of the eighth and it goes to the bottom of the eighth and you're warming up coming into a game, I mean, they start playing Welcome to the Jungle and that thing is blaring and they are wanting blood. There's no place like that place. It was the greatest place to pitch if you knew you were going to go out there and deal, and it could be the most miserable place if you couldn't get anybody out because it just seemed like the walls were caving in on you.
We're talking to Dan Plesac for Score Stories, just throwing a log on the fire and telling some stories from yesteryear. So I'm going over your Cubs rosters, 93, 94, and there's a name on there who hit one of the furthest balls ever hit at Wrigley Field, and that is Glenn Allen Hill. Hit the ball on top of the roof. Is he the guy who could put on the best show in batting practice, or do you have a great Glenn Allen Hill story?
You know, I remember Glenn Allen Hill in his early days when he came up with the Toronto Blue Jays, because the Blue Jays like had a pipeline. But I'm going to give you a guy, and he was such an obscure guy, a young guy that the Los Angeles Dodgers thought was going to be the next Dave Kingman, a guy named Billy Ashley. This dude, I have never – you had to see it to believe it. In batting practice at Dodger Stadium, opposing teams would go out. Now, that we're talking like 1994, 1995, would go out and watch this guy take batting practice. And I'm telling you, he routinely hit balls on the top of the roof over the bleachers in left center field at Dodger Stadium. And that was like unheard of that you could hit a ball that far. And that guy had more power than anybody. Like if you're talking about raw power, Billy Ashley, the Dodgers, had more raw power than anybody I ever saw.
Wow. Since Danny took you to your Cubs days, I don't think I've ever asked you this question on or off the air, but I got an impression that those 2 years in a Cubs uniform were not real enjoyable for you. Is that accurate?
You know, very accurate, and I'll tell you why. It was a real crazy offseason. Like, I was really close. I was either signing with the Cincinnati Reds or the Toronto Blue Jays. And the Cubs came in, they jumped in the mix late, and I was like, well, you know, it ended up, we break camp, and it was myself, Chuck McElroy, Paul Assemacher, and Randy Myers. We had four lefties in the bullpen. And so there just really wasn't enough room for four guys. And, you know, my pitching, and I wasn't throwing the ball that well. And then they made a change after the first year. Tom at Treblehorn was the manager. And, you know, Dan, I thought playing like what you would say would be at home would be great, but just it was the year that a couple of years where the Kennedy was under construction. I had a home in St. Charles, and like the day that I signed, I remember I drove from St. Charles to Wrigley. It took me like 45 minutes to get there, and I thought, hey, this is going to be great, man. I get to play at home. Well, opening day, I've never made that drive because when you're an opposing player, you stay at a hotel and you take the bus in, and so you never see the traffic. So opening day, the home opener in 1993, I leave my house at like 7:30 in the morning, have to be dressed on the field at 10, pitcher stretch, because the game's at 1:10. And I leave at 7 o'clock, and I'm on the Kennedy Expressway. And, Dan, I don't get in there. It's like 2 hours later. It's like 9:15. I walk in, and like everybody's almost dressed, and here I am in my street clothes, opening day, new team, and I'm like stressed out because it took me 2 hours to get there. And yeah, Dan, it was just a lot of guys that we played with in Little League and high school and, you know, always coming down to the bullpen. And you know what? I thought it was going to be a great place to play, and it turned out to be, it wasn't as great as I thought it was going to be for me personally.
I think a lot of athletes relate to that, like the pressure of playing at home, and so it's just good to go away when not as many people can have their hand out.
You know what's crazy? When you grow up in the area and you grew up watching, you know, 2, 5, 7, and 9, the local news, those guys are your guys. Those guys are your guys. And when you're playing in Milwaukee or you're playing in Toronto and, you know, you're dealing on the national level, you don't really get too comfortable with Bob Costas. You don't get comfortable with Tony Kubek or Tim McCarver because you're only going to see him one or two times a game. But when you grow up in that area, you just felt like it was everything was cool, and to you, you wanted to do so well, and it was just – I spent more time driving than being at the ballpark, and that's part of it that I didn't realize was going to be that way. And then all in day games. So you have a 1:20 day game Monday through Thursday, and the game's over at 4 o'clock, and they try to get out of the parking lot, and you know what it's like in Wrigleyville, and you get in your car, and you've had a bad day, and you hear it's 1:10 out in the big airport, and I'm thinking, geez, I'm 25 minutes past the big airport. So it was like 6:30 in the morning to 7 o'clock at night. It was like, it was just a long day. And it almost, to me, it was like almost better to go on a road trip than be at home. It was a lot more convenient on the road for me than it was at home.
How was Sammy Sosa as a teammate in 93 and 94?
Yes. Dan, you know, this was before he really burst onto the scene. I like Sammy. I mean, you know, Dan, we could talk about all the superstars in baseball or any sport. Do they get preferential treatment? Of course they do, Dan. They all do. I played with Roger Clemens. He won 2 Cy Young Awards in 97 and 98 with the Blue Jays. You know, the days that he pitched, he dressed in the back room. I mean, he was a great guy to be around, but the days he pitched, you know, didn't talk to anybody. And did he have to go to pitcher's fielding practice on a day off in 2 weeks? No, he flew home to Houston. But you know what? That comes with the superstar players. And Sammy Sosa, you know, that was really when in 93, 94, he was just really starting to come into his own. And he turned out to be this phenomenon 4 or 5 years later. But I found him, I can only tell you from the 2 years that I played with Sammy, he was fun to play with.
How many beers could Mark Grace have and still function?
Good question. As many as you could possibly get. This I will tell you about Mark Grace. You know, I've had some great guys that I play with, and I put Mark Grace in that small picture. Jim Tomey's in that picture. No matter what he did, how long he was out, whatever he did, I'm going to tell you something. That guy came to play every day. And I know he's a funny guy, and he, you know, he has this this whole appeal about the nature of Mark Grace. But I'm going to tell you what. I saw it for 2 years. I saw it in spring training. I saw it every day. When it time to be at 10 o'clock, to be at the field, he was at the field at 10 o'clock. He was in Dragon. He was, I would put him on that small, if I had a chart of 10 guys that were my favorite teammates, he is without a doubt one of those 10. He was one of those guys that you played with, that you hoped he was what you thought he was, and that's what he was. He was that good of a dude.
Wow, that's cool. It's good to hear stuff like that. Hey, on the baseball tour, 20 years in the big leagues, afterward as a broadcaster, who's the coolest celebrity you ever had a chance to meet? Doesn't necessarily have to be an athlete. Tell us a story about spending time with somebody who was really, really cool.
Dan, I tell you what, you know, one of the things I marvel at with this job at MLB Network, you get to do a lot of things on a national level, and when the World Series, Kansas City Royals, and the Mets, 2015, 2016, we had Tim McGraw on the set. Me, Mark DeRosa, and Brian Kenny were introduced. We were interviewing Tim McGraw. You know, he had the hat on, and, you know, and it was just so cool. We went to break singing a Tim McGraw song, and he said, "All right, fellas, I'm going to start the song, and you guys finish it off till commercial break." And it was one of those moments, Dan, like when we went to commercial break, you almost had to pinch yourself and say, I can't believe this, right? This kid from Gary, Indiana, Crown Point High School, you know, I never in a million years thought I would be doing that or standing behind the batting cage, shaking hands, you know, and talking to Sandy Koufax. And you come away from those moments thinking, you know, man, this game's been good to me. It's been really, really good to me. And I've been so blessed, Dan. This ride has taken me to places I never thought it would be. I mean, I went from a senior in high school. I was signed. I was going to go play basketball at NC State. Baseball got in the way. You know, I got drafted in the second round, decided that's where I was going to go. And, Dan, here I am at 58 years old, still able and being around the game that I love. And I tell you, I enjoy what I do. I love going out to the ballpark. And you know when you struggle with this, I think everybody does with their life and their career, that you feel like you don't really need that part of your life, that doesn't define you. And I think you wrestle with this when you get done playing baseball, that you don't want that sport to define you as a person. You appreciate what it was able to give you, but I think the longer this has gone on, Dan, the more that I've realized I never knew how much. I'll give you a story from, I was in Stockton, California in 1985. And I was playing in the California League. And I was really, you know, top prospect. I'm really pitching well at the All-Star break. I'm starting the California League All-Star team. And my manager, Tim Norbrook, who got a cup of coffee in the big leagues with the Brewers. I mean, like maybe less than 30 days. When you're a starting pitcher in the minor leagues, you pitch Monday, and on Tuesday you have what's called the bucket. That means when batting practice the next day, you stand behind second base, behind that screen, and when you hit the balls in batting practice, they throw them into you, you put them in the bucket, and you run them into the guy that's throwing batting practice. Every starting pitcher in the minor leagues hates that job, the bucket day. So I'm doing the bucket. Tim Norbrook came up to me, and he says, hey, I've got to ask you something. I said, yeah. He goes, hey, do you remember your first girlfriend? I said, yeah, Mary Kay. He goes, you know what you got to do? He goes, did you love Mary Kay? And I said, yeah, I think I did. I was 18. He goes, you know what you got to do? You have to love baseball. You need to wrap your arms around baseball, and you need to hug it and nurture it like you've never done before. You need to love baseball more than anything in the world. Love baseball. And he walked away from me. And I'm like, man, what an odd conversation. So it bothered me for like 2 days. So I went into his office. He had one of those open door policies. Hey, you have anything? You can always knock on my door and come in. So I knocked on that door and I said, hey, Norty, I got a question. I said, were you calling me out? He goes, what do you mean? I go, you asked me if I loved baseball. He goes, damn right I'm calling you out. He goes, you're too good to be here in A-ball right now. You need to be a Double-A. And you know what? You got a chance to pitch in the big leagues, and you have the chance to stay in the big leagues. I got a cup of coffee. You need to love this. And from that day on, I kid you not, I bought the book, The Art of Pitching by Tom Seaver. And Dan, I was the kind of guy that if you told me to run 10 laps, I ran 10 laps. If you told me to run 2 miles, I ran 2 miles. I was never late, but I never was the last one to leave either. And from that point on, I bought that book, and I decided if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to go all in because I didn't have a plan B. Plan A was make it. There was no plan B. And here I am, and I'm still in plan A right now at 58 years old. And if it weren't for Tim Norbrook, he gave me a wake-up call, Dan. He gave me a wake-up call to say, you're really good, but you know what? You need to work more than you're working. And that was my wake-up call.
Very cool.
That's great stuff.
Very cool. Yeah. I hope every now and again you shoot him a text or a Christmas card and say thank you. Good.
I do. Yeah, I do. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have helped Dan Plesac get to where he's at. And Tim Norbrook is one of those guys that, you know, a lot of people don't know about Tim Norbrook. But that was my wake-up call, Dan, in the summer with the Stockton Ports, 1984, in the California League.
Anyone who makes Dan Plesac go Dan Plesac in the third person is a friend of this show as well, Sack.
I sound like Rich Peterson now, don't I?
That was incredible. A lot of people have helped Dan Plesac get to this moment. Very thankful. Hey, Dan, thank you so much, man, and stay safe. Thank you for the time, your generous stories. We appreciate you.
And next time we'll get into some Ricky Henderson stories. How about that?
Oh, sounds good, Zach. Thank you, Danny. Have a great night, man. Okay. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Mac, there's just something special about when a guest goes third person, isn't there? I can't help but point it out.
Yes. Oh, every time. And right at the end, too. Yes. Period.
It was the perfect dismount.
Oh, really. Absolutely.
Ricky Henderson's on that list, by the way, like with Bo Jackson, of guys that's just like stories about them you cannot get enough of. There's so many of them, and they don't even feel real. It's mythical almost.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, I'm surprised you guys didn't hear me back here.
I was screaming when he said that we left Ricky Henderson's stories on the table. I was irate back here. I want nothing but Ricky Henderson stories. He is Danny.
He was on for 30 minutes. I mean, I can call him back, do a second segment like Steve Stone. I'm always down for some Ricky. We'll book Dan Plesac next week just for Ricky Henderson stories. How's that sound?
Yeah, we'll get him on the 30th of every month until we have the coronavirus figured out and they start playing games again. It'll be part
Perfect.
Two. Yeah.
we were so up, and then you had to bring us down. There was a piece of Score audio that just washed all over one of us. You'll hear it next on the.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. and great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track 4 games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Score. I'll tell you, the text lines and everything just lights up. And people actually who have stopped me in the grocery store specifically have mentioned this segment as making them smarter and better football fans because of your insight. The Bernstein and McKnight Show will grab you a nice, big, expensive piece of meat somewhere.
And I'll come to Chicago for business and we can go to Gibson's and you guys can buy me a steak.
Sage Rosenfels.
He's been great all season.
Amazing resource.
You learn a lot. Like the little things to look for in Mitch's day that you didn't, you know, you watch through it and it washes over you.
We love when it washes over us, Mac. The Bernstein McKnight Show does that to both of us each and every day from 9 to noon right here on The Score.
Let me tell you something. I don't know how many times I've heard that soundbite. It still tickles me to no end that's what people would stop Dan Bernstein to talk about whenever he's in a Mariano's, wherever he might. Well, hey, aren't you Dan Brim? Boy, that's Sage Rosenfels. That just and Connor's enthusiasm at the end. You know, I never have really considered Parkins until this virus the proper way to wash my hands. I've really never spent any time thinking about it. But Bernsey tweeted something out today regarding how to wash your hands. And if it comes with this guy's endorsement, and he also is retweeting it, as well as Dan Bernstein, then it's something I think we all should let wash over us. Let's give it a listen.
Get some fresh air. Don't forget to wash your hands really well. There's a video, by the way, and I retweeted this. I want to say our guy Sage Rosenfels did too. It's someone in Spain did a video while wearing white latex gloves and using a dark pigment as if it's the soap and just showing how to actually properly wash your hands. It sounds a little silly, but when you see it laid out like this, it's a really graphic way of looking at the areas on our hands that we forget.
Do you watch through it and it washes over you?
I'm watching the video right now. I just retweeted it so all of our listeners can let it wash all over them. You know how many people have watched this here video, Parkins? Take a guess at how many people. The one that Dan Bernstein was just describing, the Asian video with the latex gloves.
1 million.
19 million. 19 million people have seen this particular video. That is the official Score video, I think. I'm declaring it without even discussing it with Mitch Rosen that is the official Score video on how to wash your hands. If it comes with Bernsey and Sage Rosenfels endorsements, then it's got to be good. Wash your hands.
So what you're saying is a video about washing your hands washed all over you.
That's exactly what I'm telling you happened this morning.
All right, that's great.
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
It's just so funny that he just threw that in there to me. Sage Rosenfels retweeted.
Get some fresh air. Don't forget to wash your hands really well. There's a video, by the way, and I retweeted this. I want to say our guy Sage Rosenfels did too.
It must be good then.
Sage Rosenfels signs off on it. That's the hand washing video you need.
Yes, it is.
No other hand washing videos will suffice.
He was at Iowa State the day they taught hand washing.
I will say, man, like you do learn some things about yourself during quarantine. You learn about like, oh man, my hands are starting to get real dry. Like, you know what I mean? You gotta put some lotion on after all of this hand washing.
So how many times now, because you don't go out, it's easy to assume we're okay if we just stay in. I have to remind myself I haven't washed my hands in a couple hours. It's true I haven't left the house, but I probably should wash my hands. Is that what you're doing also?
Well, I'm washing my hands a lot, and also, Steph is being very vigilant and hyper-vigilant, you might be able to argue, which I have, about it. And not that I don't think it's very important. It is. But so, like, for instance, we live, like I told you, know, in a little mini-rise condo building. And so to put out the trash, there's, like, a trash chute on the floor. And there's only four units on our floor. But so to take off the trash, I got to go out into the hallway and then open up the trash chute and have it go down. And so if I open up my door handle and put, like, my hand inside my sleeve, so my sleeve is touching the metal of the door handle, and then my sleeve is touching the handle of the trash chute, and then I come back in 12 seconds later, like, yes, technically I did leave our self-quarantine in our apartment, but I didn't touch anything. If I don't then immediately go and wash my hands, and I'm talking immediately, I'll get chastised for not washing my hands. So
that's fair.
You know.
That's fair, and if your sleeve touches, you probably should change shirts, right?
I guess,
non-committal.
Well, you're supposed to. So you got to change your clothes every time you go outside.
If it touches garbage or if it touches something else somebody's touched, that's the thing. They don't know about all these hard surfaces yet. There's not enough evidence out there as to how long it lives, how much of at risk we are touching hard surfaces. We don't know yet.
Are you guys at the point where you're disinfecting your groceries?
No.
Have you thought about doing that?
I'm not.
I wore gloves
while pushing the cart the last time I was at the grocery store and when I unpacked, but that was it.
Yeah, I wear gloves when I go, and I go early in the morning typically where there's not a lot of people around and you're not waiting in lines and you're not violating people's, you know, personal space or whatever. But, you know, you're considering the bags that you're bringing into the house, like, you know, the reusable bags, like, okay, let's make sure those aren't in the house for too long, wipe them down, and then set them outside so the virus can die if they're on the bags. But I watched a video yesterday, and in the video they recommend, you know, you're soaking all of your fruits and vegetables for an extended period of time and letting your dry goods be outside for a long time so the virus can die out, and then they're wiping off all the groceries that were in the house. I'm like, oh, this may be a step too far. I know, you know, being overly cautious is good now, but there's, you know, you're looking around your house like, oh, I brought that in from outside. Should I wipe that off? It's really weird.
Right. Yeah. Well, so Dr. Fauci, who's the foremost authority in all of this, it is true, like, the virus can live longer on a metallic surface than other surfaces. And, you know, there are stories about, you know, an Amazon factory having infection, so then you get
Oh, God, don't get me started with all the equipment that we've been getting for my wife's at-home setup. Like, there's packages coming every day multiple times, and you're just, like, looking at all these boxes in your house, like, oh, my God. Like, it's already here.
Right. But one of the things he said is, he's like, what we know is the easiest way for this to be transmitted is by not washing your hands and by ignoring social distancing and coming in contact with other people, people-to-people transmissions of it. And so, like, at some point, there's a trade-off with your own paranoia and anxiety levels, right? Like, if you could a package delivered to your home give you coronavirus? Yes, that is it is mathematically possible. But are you going to disinfect every piece of mail that you get, every piece of food? Like, how much time in your day are you going to spend on that? Like, that's a decision that is up to each and every person, I suppose. And for me, so far, I have enough anxiety about all of this, and we're staying home and staying within just the three of us, that I have not gotten to that level of paranoia personally. I'm not telling anyone else what to do, but I'm not at that point yet.
I am at that point with the mail. The mail sits in the garage for a day. I give it one day. I don't know why I designated that as long enough, but as I did, I have a little area right outside the door, which leads into the garage. That's my smoking station. And that's, I now have a mail slot. I keep the mail there for one day before I bring it in the house, and I make sure I wash my hands immediately after I handle the mail. Look, yesterday I had to go to the gas station because I was 22 miles until empty, and I don't like to push it too much farther than that, maybe just a tick, but not much farther than that. And I used one of the paper towels from the dispenser, and you put the credit card in there, and you have to punch in your zip code so it takes your card, and doing all of that through a tissue and then immediately discarding that. But that's where I am with pretty much all of this stuff, and doing my very best not to touch any buttons, touch as few buttons as possible. I've always been a bit of a germaphobe. This is going to make me largely worse than I already was.
Okay, well, so actually, so you're a good person to talk to about this. Whenever this is over, 6 months, 3 months, whenever it's over, and it's, okay, we're down to zero cases and a vaccine has been found, maybe that's not 12 months, 18 months, but whenever it's, we can say it's over. How much of your behavior as a germaphobe do you think you will change? Like, for instance, would you be less likely to go to a restaurant that has tables really close to one another? Will you be less likely to shake someone's hand? Will you not get on an airplane as frequently? Like, I'm curious what types of things in our life are going to change on the back end of this, whenever this is in our rearview mirror and we can kind of take stock of the changes we made while it was going on.
Yeah, lots of discussion about the handshake, whether it's going to become passe. I don't know. I suppose I might be for quite some time very, very, you know, leery of it. And I was with a friend over the weekend who's a very affectionate dude. And I told him as soon as he saw me walking up his driveway, I said, 6 feet minimum, man. Which is weird because he's a hugger. And probably if I hadn't said that, probably I didn't even want to walk in the house. But I would guess that most of us are going to have reservations about the handshake or even the fist bump for some time. That's my suspicion.
Me too. Like I was talking about it with my brother. It's like, okay, so even if they clear us to resume normal activities, are you really interested in being around a whole bunch of people anytime soon?
No.
Me neither.
No, I'm not. Nor am I interested in sharing marijuana with anybody anytime soon. Not because I want to Bogart it all to myself. I'll just give you your own little wrap and your own little bud so you can get the plane in the air on your own.
Yeah, listen, man, you joke. Like, all of those things you just start to think about, right? And again, this to me is not fear-mongering. Once the medical community says, you know, we can resume activities as scheduled, then everybody will make their own decisions and is free to make their own decisions as you want. But I do think there's going to be a healthy percentage of the population that acts differently once we get through this. Like, if people your age and older are saying that they've never lived through anything like this, like, this will be a formative event in people's lives. I was talking to my little sister who, you know, doesn't remember September 11th. She's just a little over a year removed from graduating from college. And, you know, this is the biggest event of her life, right?
Yeah. Yes. Probably.
Right? Fair, right? Early 20s?
I would think so.
In terms of one that she would remember?
Yes,
and, like,
she doesn't remember 9/11. Yes. This
right?
would probably be it.
So this is going to be one of those formative things for people. Positive, negative, like every generation, you know, you all have so many of them that you remember. You remember exactly where you were. You remember exactly what changed because of it, how you changed your behaviors. And a lot of events happen. We say, oh, we're going to change our behaviors, and then we don't. But some things have lasting ramifications. And my guess is this one is going to have some, and we have no idea what they're going to be yet. But like an example of it, I don't know if you've been using Zoom recently or if you know anything about Zoom. Zoom is becoming ubiquitous within society. It's basically just a better version of FaceTime and Skype and Facebook video and all that. And the stock is down a little bit today, but it's just been ripping the last month. It's video conferencing that works. And I don't know what percentage of the American workforce worked from home before this, but I got to think it's going to at least double on the back end of this.
Yeah, I'd be guessing if I thought doubling was right. It's going to go up, and it's going to go up significantly. Does it double? I'm not so sure. I think money is also going to be something that changes, and it already has to a very large degree. But I think even even the older crowd, boomers like me who tease guys your age and your mid-30s there because you never have any cash on you, I'm not really that interested in handling cash anymore after this. Nor am
Venmo,
I interested.
Baby.
Yeah, I know. Well, and to the point where you can use your phone and the phone not have to make contact with the device at whatever retailer you're at. That's where this is going. People don't
want
to touch. Yeah, well, I know. People don't want to touch the buttons. You pay for it with a credit card, you got to touch buttons. You want this to be as touch-free as absolutely possible, and I don't know how to use that technology. I'm sure it's available to me, but I haven't used it before.
Yeah, well, it is available, whether it's, you know, Apple Wallet or, you know, like the Amazon app for if you go to a Whole Foods, you can scan out that way, or, you know, any other number of things where you can just scan. But at a grocery store checkout, do you go through the line and be around other people, or do you go through the self-checkout where you got to touch the buttons on the screen and all of that stuff? But I agree with you. We're certainly going to be going away to paperless currency, and we're already moving in that way in a direction, which actually gives me a minute here to plug something that I've been doing and something I know Shane Reardon is doing on Twitter, at Danny Parkins on Twitter. You can follow it. I was feeling when this started, Mac, when I was on paternity leave and you and Spiegs were hosting, and I had previously scheduled it, but it was very clear that this situation was going to get very, very serious very, very soon. I was feeling a little helpless and had about $354 in my Venmo balance left over. And I was like, you know what? That's an amount of money that I can afford to donate right now. Very fortunate. And so I put it out there. I said, if people reach out to me who are in need, I will try to get you some money in need, hopefully because – not hopefully, but as a result of – the cause was because of the COVID-19 crisis. I was going to try to be the middleman, and people could send me money on Venmo, and then I would send it to the people who are reaching out in need, and my $354 was the first seed money. And it took off in a way that I wasn't really expecting. This guy, Shea Serrano, is the first person I ever saw do this type of crowdfunding, and it's been really cool. By the time, probably within an hour of us being off the air today, I will have given away another $3,000 today, which is my weekly limit that Venmo allows me to transfer. So it'll be three consecutive Mondays of giving away $3,000. And the people that I've reached that have reached out to me, it's been freelance journalists, waiters, waitresses, bartenders, Uber drivers, you know, the gig economy, managers of restaurants trying to help with payroll, parents who get laid off and are trying to help. You know, someone reached out today and said that they were $120 short of a used laptop for their daughter, as her daughter needed to get set up to do his daughter needed to get set up to do the homeschooling. And it's been really cool with all of this bad news to see all of these people come together. And I've been sharing the amount that I've sent and their Venmo handle on social media. And so, say, you know, I've sent a lot of people today $300, and people have messaged me and said that people in the replies have started coming in, you know, from the McNeil and Parkins mob, my social media following. They've seen their Venmo, and maybe they've got $10 or they got $50 or they got $30, whatever they have that they can spare, and they're piling on to some of these people's causes. And so it's been a really cool, rewarding thing, but I'm just plugging it here because I'm not doing all the $3,000 myself, far from it. And so I need as many people who are going to be donating to me for me to be able to keep donating it out. And David Hochberg made a big donation last week, great friend of the station and the show. And he's helping Shane Reardon out as well. Some sports media people anonymously have made donations. It's been cool to see. And we were talking about how when really bad things happen, people to come together and do some good things. And so I'm just, like I said, the middleman. A lot of people in our audience are stepping up in a really big, meaningful way and helping a lot of Chicago area people who are economically impacted by the coronavirus. And so I just wanted to plug it on the air so that, because a lot of people are reaching out from all over the country. And frankly, there are people on the internet who take advantage of this sort of charitable deed and seem to be professional askers for money on the internet. And so like that's discouraging. And like I've had people clearly kind of try to scam me and set up different accounts and all that stuff. Right. So I wanted to talk about it a little bit on the air so that the people who like spread it around to people who you think might need it, or if you can donate, we can kind of keep this within the Score and McNeil and Parkins family. So I'm Danny-Parkins on Venmo. You can see all the information on my Twitter page.
Nice job, dude. Well done on your part. And Sherry and I have made a donation to the Chicago Food Depository, but I clearly agree with everything you said, and I think it's a good thing, and particularly not to prioritize one line of work over another, but an industry that is going to take a beating for some time. And we just talked about it, not directly about this, but something related to it not long ago, and that is gathering in groups. I mean, once this thing calms down, I don't think a lot of people are going to be in a hurry to go sit in a restaurant. So for people who make their livings cooking, waiting tables, bartending, whatever you do in a restaurant, those are the people who are going to be taking a beating for the longest period of time, or certainly for a very long period of time. And we have tried to do our fair share in ordering carryout, and I have noticed an incredible appreciation for the restaurants down here in Indiana where we're at. Everybody's coming out with curbside service, and everybody has a smile on his or her face, and they're doing the very best they can during what's been a very challenging time for them, with a ton of certainty around the corner. When your living is predicated on a very small hourly wage and tips, and that's taken away from you with no sign of it coming back anytime soon. And when it does, it's going to be a fraction of it once was. There are people dealing with some serious financial hardships, and I feel for them, and I would just do whatever I can a couple times a week to support local carryout. I think that's important.
No question about it. Just a kind deed, right? We have to social distance, but we can't come apart. So whatever you can do during these times to help people out. And if people are texting in saying that they wish that they could contribute, maybe you could get on social media and retweet it. Like, just spread it around so that maybe someone who sees it who is able to do it. Like, everybody is able. There's ways you could donate blood where there's going to be a blood shortage. Like, there are ways to volunteer in safe environments passing out food. That was part of the daily briefing today. Chicago, what was it? Chicago.gov/coronavirus under the resources tab had a lot of ways for people who can contribute during these times, because we're going to need to get through this together. So you don't have to have a bunch of money to be able to donate in order to be a part of the solution. So again, that was chicago.gov/coronavirus. It's McNeil and Parkins on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.